This version of the podcast is mixed in mono, but if you would like to listen in 5.1 surround sound, please visit ufocast.co.uk/prisoner for more details. This is episode 13, but we recorded it third back in December 2021. Hello and welcome to episode 13 of By Hook or By Crook, our prisoner podcast. And tonight's guest, well actually no, hello, I'm Luke, and my co-host is, as ever,
Michael. Yep.
And our guest tonight, same as always. And my guest tonight, it gives me great pleasure to welcome my dad. Obviously, you're not all going to call him my dad, because he's just my dad to me. His name's Alan. Hello, Dad.
Hello.
Hello, good, Alan. There you go.
Good to be with you.
Fantastic. So we are slightly short for time this evening because we've had some technical issues. So we're going to dive straight in with the usual interview. And Michael appears to have lost one of his earphones. Dad, so how and why did you get into The Prisoner?
I actually watched the original run of the series in 1967. I was only, I must have been 12 at the time. So my perspective initially is fairly limited. You know, I didn't have any understanding of anything other than straightforward adventure stories. So I came to The Prisoner from having watched The Danger Man, the previous Danger Man episodes. And I remember seeing the advert for The Prisoner, I think, in the Radio Times, or the TV Times as it was then, and thinking, oh, that looks like another series of Danger Men. But then when I realized it was a different title, I was intrigued. And like most people at the time, I was intrigued from the first episode, I think. And it became one of those things you just had to watch every week.
And did you miss an episode at any point? Do you think you saw it all on original broadcast?
I think I saw every episode, but I can't be sure now because I've seen all the episodes so many times afterwards that one's original memory is probably not that reliable. But I certainly know that I saw the first episode live, and I definitely saw the last episode live because the whole country was eagerly waiting for this denouement, which obviously, as everybody knows, turned out to be an absolute complete and utter surprise and bafflement and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. Well, so we are assuming, we're hoping that some of our listeners will be watching The Prisoner for the first time. So we can't go into spoilers.
Okay, fine.
In terms of particulars of Fallout. But, yeah. It generally, were you satisfied with how the series panned out? Given that you started off thinking, oh, this is more Danger Man, and then it was something completely different. And you were 12, yes. Well, I think you were 13 by the time it finished. Did it make any sense to you at all, or were you disappointed with how
it ended up? I was basically disappointed.
Right.
I didn't think about ringing into ITV saying, what's all this nonsense? But I think it was just so baffling that I didn't really think it rounded the series off. I mean, what I was expecting, I don't know. But I don't think I was expecting what happened.
What happened? Okay.
No.
And because you were watching on original broadcast in the UK in the late 60s, although it was made in colour, and we can now obviously enjoy it in glorious high-def Blu-ray, I think you've got the DVD box set, but you would have originally watched this in black and white. Do you recall how different a series it was in black and white? Or again, having watched it since in colour, has that sort of wiped away that? Because to me, it's such a colourful series.
I think because black and white was the norm, I don't think you thought about it very much. I mean, I was aware that the Americans could watch black and colour television. And for some reason, we were behind them in the colour television stakes. But it was so normal that it there's nothing to think about. It was black and white, and that was it. Everything was black and white.
And you didn't get colour until the 70s, I believe, or you didn't see colour until.
I didn't see colour television until my uncle got a colour television, and my auntie got a colour television, but they were so expensive that very few people could afford the thing. So our first colour television was in 1989, 3 years after you were born.
5 years after I was born, Dad.
Sorry, 5 years. Yes,
the girls were three in 1980.
Yes.
Anyway,
3 years,
yes,
5 years after you were born.
I remember black and white telly. Just about.
We had a black and white TV, and my grandma had a colour one, and her colour TV was from Radio Rentals. So that's how. Yeah, wasn't exactly affordable, but you could pay every week. So yeah.
So that was you, aged sort of 12, 13, encountering this bizarre show. How did you revisit it later in life, and why, I suppose? Why did you keep coming back to it?
Well, I think the next time I watched it was when, for some reason, your brother John got some videos, I think. Is that right?
Well, John started collecting them, but my recollection is that you had seen some repeats on Channel 4. Because I remember there was definitely a point where you were taping it off the telly.
And I think you might have then,
like you did with Thunderbirds, where you were like, when Thunderbirds came back on, you were like, hey kids, this is a thing from my childhood, you should watch this. And obviously we did, and we followed you in that. I suspect that was where it started. That's my recollection anyway.
Well,
but yes.
I've had the DVDs now for quite a long time, I can't remember how it started, that we started to revisit the thing. But that must have been quite a long time after the first broadcast. So I think I was probably surprised about every episode apart from the last one.
Right.
Which still stuck in my... Well, I think the last two episodes stuck in my mind. Everything else was reasonably hazy until it was brought back to life through watching it again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my recollection, I shared this at the beginning of this series of podcasts, was that in describing what the series was, you basically spoiled the big reveal from the final episode.
Oh, dear.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I don't mind, because I don't think that massively impinges on my enjoyment of the show. But I think you were like, it's this show about da-da-da-da-da, and this happens, da-da-da-da-da. and you're right, obviously. So John started collecting the VHS, so did I. And so I guess that was your way of revisiting the show. Hmm. What made you pick up the DVDs for yourself and continue watching it after we'd left home?
Well, obviously, the quality was then a lot better on DVD. And I just, having seen some of the episodes again, I just thought it was a fantastic show. There's nothing ever like The Prisoner I've ever seen since. It was one of those unique programs that's why it's got this sort of cult status, I think. It is so unusual as to be irrepeatable. I mean, the so-called remake... I didn't rate that at all. It wasn't half as good as the original Prisoner. I don't think it could be.
Yeah.
Because I think McGoohan is the person that everything hangs together around McGoohan.
Yes.
And I always thought, even when he was in Danger Man, I thought he was I don't suppose I thought about people being great actors or anything, but he just had that kind of something about him that made you want to watch what he was in.
Right. So before we get onto this week's episode, my final question for our guests is, what does The Prisoner mean to you? How do you interpret it? Because various people have put various spins on what's actually going on over the years. How do you interpret it? Do you interpret it, or do you just let it wash over you, I guess?
I don't think I interpret it in the sense of having a one-to-one correspondence between the episodes and things about real life. I just think that the whole concept is just interesting. You've got this guy in this strange situation, and he's trying his best not to be sucked into it and fighting it whenever he can. As he says in one of the episodes, I'm going to find out who the warders are and who are the prisoners, and I'm going to come back and blow it up at some point. That kind of thing. It's again, because it's such an unusual series, it doesn't really have to mean anything. I think in the end, I keep watching the thing because, A, it's got some interesting stories. The actors are classic people of their time. You've got Eric Portman, you've got Leo McKern, you've got Clifford Evans. Do I mean Clifford Evans?
Yes, I do. Yes.
Yeah, all those people, they were all always on the telly, always in films. And they were just very good actors, along with McGoohan.
Cool.
So interpretation for me isn't important. It's, I just like the I like the dialogue. The dialogue is so clever, in many cases. And of course, the other star of the series is Port Merion, which is again an intriguing place.
Yeah,
nothing like it in the UK, obviously.
So although you've got McGoohan being, you know, a fantastic actor, the one episode that we're talking about tonight, he's hardly in it.
Well, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? I know why he wasn't in it. I mean, because he wasn't available. So they had to find some way of creating an episode without him.
Yeah.
But he's still there in the sense that you hear his voice. Mm. And although, obviously, Nigel Stock is not Patrick McGoohan, you've got another fantastic actor from the period being both the Colonel and being McGoohan in the Colonel's body. So
And very, very briefly at the end, Seltzman.
Yes, very briefly at the end.
So I guess that's the question. Why have you chosen... Because you had I consulted you and John quite early on in this process, so you had the whole field of episodes to choose from, and I think you narrowed it down to this one and Hammer into Anvil. So why? And Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling is, as far as I can understand, largely despised by prisoner fandom. So why do you like it? Why do you want to talk about it?
I didn't know it was despised by prisoner fandom when I chose it. So I chose it on what I thought was merit in terms of the plot and the acting. And the only flaw in the story, I think, is at the end where they could easily have got him back, having realised who he was.
Yes.
They could have got him. They could have flown the helicopter back and recaptured him, but that's a minor point.
Yeah, because they do that in other episodes.
They do that all the time.
In episode one,
yeah.
The prisoner steals the helicopter.
Yeah.
It becomes a drone, remote control, turns around, comes back.
Yeah.
The Seltzman is on the helicopter.
Yes.
And see you, bye.
Well, also, it occurred to me today, like if depending on which location for the village you go by, but if you assume it's somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, then those helicopters aren't going to get you back to land anyway. They must fly you somewhere else before... Anyway, as far as the plotting goes, you think it hangs together as a sort of coherent story. And
yes,
and Stock is a good stand-in for McGoohan.
Obviously, he's a totally different kind of actor, but I think one of the reasons I've chosen him because he was also the best... Watson to Sherlock Holmes in the BBC television series of the time.
Right.
In my opinion, he's the best Watson bar none of all the Watsons I've seen.
Right, well, that's quite the claim.
It is quite a claim, and other people would disagree with me, but he's that classic British actor. You know, he could do all sorts of things, but, you know, he's... In the Prisoner, he plays his part, I think, so well in all the scenes, you know, with his fiance in confronting Danvers. Is it Danvers? He says,
"Yeah."
He sort of dismisses Danvers as a bit of a buffoon, really, and a bit of a dodgy character. And then he goes off to Austria in the end, is it? To find Seltzman. Obviously, The sort of driving around in the car is a bit sort of cardboardy.
It's very ITC, yeah.
Yeah. But, yes, the interaction with Clifford Evans as the as number two, I think this the whole thing just hangs together very well for me.
Do we know why this is despised by fandom in general? But the only thing that I can think it might be is that you've got the love interest with Janet, which you don't have in any other Prisoner episode. And she's never mentioned. There are no photographs. And it kind of contradicts the episode where he makes it home by himself, and, you know, chimes of Big Ben and all those. So is that probably why? But, or is it because McGowan's not in it? I mean, why would somebody not like this episode?
I think as regards the inconsistencies with other episodes, I mean, that's the whole problem. That's the biggest problem with The Prisoner. There are masses of inconsistencies between episodes as to who he is, what he's been doing, where the village is. It's somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean. It's somewhere in the eastern. It's all sorts of places, but it's never consistent. Yeah. So I don't think inconsistency is a fault that's unique to this episode.
Well, one of the things I was going to ask is, because we know the real world reason for McGowan not being in it. We've got Ice Station Zebra being recorded.
Yeah.
But there's a myth that goes around that he was making Ice Station Zebra in order to pay for the rest of the episodes to be made so that all 17 could be finished.
Oh, I see.
But physically I can't see how that would ever work, because obviously the whole thing's being paid for by Lou Grade. But I had heard that myth being repeated time and time again. It was saying, oh, yes, he had to finish off paying for it with his own money. And I'm thinking, really?
That's an interesting story. I mean, I don't follow it. I don't follow the sort of websites too often.
No.
And I certainly haven't heard that one.
But no, I've been reading some very, very old books that I've been sort of collecting over the years. And for this, I've finally cracked them open and gone, oh, I'll just have a bit of a read. So, you know, I've been reading Alex Cox's guide, where this is the one episode that goes against his theory that the prisoner definitely wasn't a spy. He was a rocket engineer, because lots of other hints and things come up about him being an engineer and not particularly good at being a spy. He's not very good at noticing some of the spy type things, as opposed to the character Danger Man, who would have been, you know, able to spot all those things. So trying to differentiate between the two.
Oh, okay.
But this episode blatantly makes him just go, nope, he's definitely a spy. And it is a bit, I must admit, the mind swap thing, given a different author, it could have ended up a lot like one of the episodes of The Avengers, like with Peel and Steed, where, you know, you've got your Russian agents who are inhabiting other people's bodies kind of thing. It does have the feel of one of those slightly tongue-in-cheek, weird science episodes of The Avengers.
Yes.
But here it's played very much straight. And it ticks all the boxes. You know, it's got the guy in Whitehall who bears no resemblance or connection to any of the other people that we've seen who run, you know, the prisoner, which again goes against the grain. So are different people in charge now, or is it just a different office? But for me, the only real difference is the Janet thing, because it goes against the whole McGowan not kissing thing.
Yes.
You don't get anywhere else. You just get that relationship, and then it's like, oh, here's Janet, and then she's in it for a while. You know, she's like the pivotal point. You know, she's the holder of the receipt that lets you get the photographs, that lets you solve the mystery, which is nice for like one episode. But she's also apparently his fiance, which is never mentioned, and she's never used to try and get information out of the prisoner before. She's never used for anything that you would think the village would have used her for. So it's curious. Maybe that's the reason it's disliked. I just haven't really been able to figure it out.
Well, it's just one more inconsistency, isn't it?
Well, exactly.
You know, I don't know who wrote the episode. I mean, did they write other episodes?
It says in my notes, Vincent Tilsley. But unfortunately, for this sort of thing, I usually rely on Luke because he knows far more than me. he's got a capacity to learn more facts and retain them, because I can read them and go, oh yeah, that's fine. Are you familiar at all with Big Finish, the people who make the audio dramas?
No, not at all.
Basically, in the last couple of years, there's been an audio version of The Prisoner written, created, and they've taken lots of episodes, and the ending is very, very different. Once it gets, you've got the whole narrative, it's all there. The guy they've got to do the Patrick McGoohan character, the actual prisoner, he's got a superb voice. He's really close to McGoohan. But the main ending of that does rely on the Seltzman storyline in the way that the TV series clearly doesn't even go there. So it's like it's really absorbed into the narrative. So if ever you weren't happy with the way that The Prisoner ended, go away and listen to that instead, because okay. It does make it a lot more cohesive, and it's a thing of beauty, to be honest, storyline-wise.
Right.
See, I've got lots of notes, but I don't really want to spoil them without him. I mean, there's kind of throwaway stuff in my notebook, stuff like, why is the amnesia room not called that on the door? Stuff like that, but that's pointless. I mean, obviously you've seen Ice Station Zebra.
No, I've never seen it.
You haven't? Oh.
I've seen snippets of it. I think I've seen the last few minutes of it when they're on the ice, but I've only read the book, and
oh right,
I don't know whether the book and the film are is the film faithful to the book or not.
You see, all I've done is seen the film, so yeah. I can't compare.
I seem to recall people saying that the film sets were completely rubbish in Ice Station Zebra. Mm. It was made on a shoestring kind of thing, but
no, fair enough. So even if it was made on a shoestring, there's no way the money could have been used to save the series in the first place.
Well, yes, that's an interesting story. Yeah, yeah.
So this is part of what would have been the second series, although obviously we experienced them all as just the 17 episodes.
Mm.
And in the second series, there's a lot more stories that don't really take place in the village. You've got, like, The Girl Who Was Death, which is kind of a lot of stock footage and out and about. You've got the cowboy episode, and then you've got basically it all finishing off. So I wonder if they were getting bored of using the village itself as a location.
I see. That's
or if the stories needed to be told, like, sort of wider. I've been thinking about that quite a lot, because you've got a lot of very insular stories. And then visually, you've got a lot of stories set elsewhere.
I hadn't noticed that about this particular episode. I mean, you mentioned The Girl Who Was Death. I mean, I understand that's quite a popular episode, but I think it's one of the weakest episodes of the whole thing, because it's almost nothing to do with the village at all.
Mm.
Really, I think that's...
Yeah, it's a cutaway episode in many respects. So this one's a lot more village-based, in the sense of the mission is being sent by number two, and the colonel then gets to go on his little mission as number six and does the investigation. So I suppose, in a sense, although it's part of the whole not really set in the village set, that is the chunk of what would have been series two, it's a lot more... Yeah, you're right. Because The Girl Who Was Death is basically it's just one joke. The whole episode is just one twisted tale, which keeps you guessing all the way through. But this one is very much, we've got something to achieve. Here's how we're going to do it. We're going to swap bodies. You were saying about the plot holes, right? They're after Seltzman in order to use the process, but they've already got his machine. So what does he actually need him for? Is it to make another one?
To reverse the process.
Right, that's quite dangerous for the colonel, though. It's like, yeah, we'll shove you in the body, we'll swap you over, and off you go. Oh, and by the way, you won't get your own body back unless you succeed. Unless somebody else succeeds. Because you never actually see that. You see the cutaway with the two beds and the lightning, and then it goes, and then there's the waking up scene. You don't really get to see it in action till, yeah, I suppose you get to see the reversal, but yeah, it's odd.
I mean, again, these holes in the plot are, I think if you took too much notice of plot holes in programs, you would, I think it's any kind of mystery drama or thing like that, whenever you do a post-mortem on it,
yeah,
I think you always find plot holes, because...
Well, to be fair, we are Doctor Who fans as well, so that's basically our entire remit, is to go, yeah, but, on a monumental level. But I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm just, let me just interject here, because I'm back and I've clearly missed 5-10 minutes of conversation. It sounds like you're getting on like a house on fire. I just left you with my dad, Michael.
That's all right.
And, no, it's fine.
I am the conversation pixie. I will talk to anyone.
Have we talked about how good my Nigel Stock is or isn't at being
Patrick
McGowan? No,
we've kept that one back.
Oh, right, okay,
because
good.
Because we thought that... But also, you're the person who knows who actors are. Now, I did spot Nigel Stock, and to be fair, I actually went, I do know him. I bet he was in Doctor Who. And I'll put my hand up. I came across the fact while I was doing my research. It was not something I came to off the top of my head.
Yes, there are two others in the Spot the Doctor Who actor, but we will get to that later.
Exactly, right.
No, because the thing I want to talk about in this episode is the whole body swap thing,
mm-hmm.
Specifically in this instance, but more generally, because it's a very well-worn trope. I don't know whether this was the first time you'd come across it, Dad, back in the 60s.
I don't know. I mean, I may have come across it. As Michael was saying, there were lots of funny things in the Avengers, which had also surreal episodes. But whether they had a body swap, I wouldn't like to say.
Because there is the question of... I'm going to throw this out there. Do you think that Nigel Stock does a good imitation of Patrick McGowan's physicality and mannerisms and speech, or not?
No. I mean, I don't think that's the point. He couldn't... As I said, I think Nigel Stock and Patrick McGowan are quite diametrically opposed kind of actors, really.
But he's supposed to be playing... He's supposed to be playing the body of a man with the mind of number six. So wouldn't you expect him, to some extent, to behave... I mean, this is the question I throw out there, because often that seems to be the sort of how these things work.
Well, he's clearly got the voice in his head is clearly Patrick McGowan's.
Yes.
And his handwriting is Patrick McGowan's.
Well, is it, though? Isn't it Nigel Stock's handwriting?
No, it's...
No, I know. As far as the story goes, it's number six's handwriting. But surely the person actually doing the writing is Nigel Stock. So clearly canonically, number six's handwriting, whether he's in Patrick McGowan's body or Nigel Stock's body, looks like Nigel Stock's handwriting in the real world.
Well, of course, yes.
Yes.
But then no one's going to think through that sort of series of logics to ask any question, I don't think.
Except I do. Well, so here's my thought, right? Because the way that body swaps tend to work is that they're judged based on how good the actor who's playing the body does impersonating the person who's supposed to have jumped into them, if that makes sense.
Got you, yeah.
Right.
I've just seen episode 2 of the latest season of What We Do in the Shadows, where the main vampire character is actually played... He's playing four people in the same episode who are all disguised as him.
Right.
And he has to impersonate, do the voice, and the mannerisms of all the people.
Exactly.
And he manages to pull off two of them really, really well.
Yeah.
So I get that, and himself. So... I get what you're saying.
My question actually is, if this were actually possible, that you could somehow separate somebody's mind from their brain and put that mind into somebody else's body, what would being in somebody else's brain and body do to you? For example, to give a kind of really extreme example, if your mind could be taken from your body and put into the body of somebody, say, with a degenerative brain condition, say Alzheimer's or something.
Yeah,
right.
Would you experience Alzheimer's, or would you be just yourself in that body? And my thought is...
You mean
is,
like a physical degeneration? Like
there's something physically wrong with the person's brain. So if you put your healthy mind into that body, you would then be afflicted by that condition, for example. Or say you were put into a body...
All right, so you're not talking about a brain swap where your brain would be in somebody else's body.
But you're talking
about consciousness.
Well, this is what the episode specifically sets up, that it's the mind that's been transferred. They clearly haven't taken Patrick McGowan's brain out of it, because it's all kind of lightning and whizzy
Star
stuff.
Trek territory.
They haven't physically operated on him and gone, right, here's a brain, we've put it into the other, but they've transferred his mind, or let's say his consciousness. So
is it a lot closer to what's the film, Get Out? The incredibly dark, brilliant horror film.
I haven't seen it, but I know the concept of you're swapping people's minds into other bodies.
Yeah.
One of the obvious pieces of physicality for me is when he's trying to count the letters to work out which slides he needs.
Yes.
And he counts the numbers on his fingers, right?
Mm. Yes.
And to me, that doesn't feel like something that Patrick McGowan would do at all.
No.
But it does feel like something very Nigel Stocky, for example.
Yeah.
So my thought is that the way that the story works is that you're basically saying, if you put somebody's mind into somebody else's body, then actually there's an interplay between those two things. And although he's playing the same character, he is affected by the fact that he's in a different body and that he then picks up the mannerisms of that body, for example. Or am I just overthinking it?
No. See, I'm approaching it more from a real-world point of view, where you've got Stock, who's an actor, and McGowan, who's a movie star. And there's that whole, you know, my favourite year where he goes, I'm not an actor, I'm a movie star, where he's got two different modes of acting. You've got really fast and intense McGowan, like caged animal, and then you've got kind of whispery version. And then you've got Stocks, who's like, can act right across the board. I mean, he was Watson to Peter Cushing's Holmes, and that's, you're going to have to know your stuff if you're standing next to Peter Cushing.
Oh, well, you see... He's also Watson to Douglas Wilmer's Sherlock Holmes.
Right. So I've not seen either of those.
Well, you see,
I want to.
Again, in my humble opinion, Douglas Wilmer is the best Holmes ever.
Right.
My dad bangs this drum very frequently, Michael.
I do bang this drum very frequently. And even,
it's a drum I'm well and truly willing to listen to.
Even revisiting that series in very poor black and white quality,
mm-hmm.
Wilmer, I still think, cuts the mustard as Holmes. And the fact that he didn't carry on and they replaced him with Peter Cushing, I think is a matter of great regret for me, because I don't think Cushing was half as good as Wilmer in the TV series. But, you know, that's my...
We're actually talking better than Jeremy Brett here.
I think if Wilmer had better... If they could... film better episodes, you know, rather than grainy black and white.
Yeah.
I think Wilmer would even stand up to Jeremy Brett. Although I have to admit he is a very good Holmes as well.
No, I'm just interested in what sort of scale we're looking at here.
Yeah.
And you're listening to the new Sherlock Holmes podcast.
Yes, we have massively digressed.
Of course, yeah.
And obviously, I missed some of your conversation while I was away.
You did, but I was asking your dad if he'd even ever come across Big Finish, because I was seeing that the Saltzman process bears a huge influence on the very end of the Prisoner series.
Yes.
And it's really milked quite extensively.
And we need to listen to that at some point.
I'm sure you will. Well, I just wanted to ask you if you've seen Ice Station Zebra.
No, I haven't.
There you go, then.
No, I mean, I know that's why he wasn't there. And they had to be like, I mean, it's also slightly crazy to me. I mean, obviously, one assumes it's quite a small part, but it's crazy to me that, like, he could go off to play a part in a movie in the space of time it took to shoot a TV episode, which was maybe, like, what, two or three weeks.
Well, one thing which I should have said at the very beginning about why the series is so good, how could I forget the music? The music is, I think, the Prisoner theme tune is the best television theme tune anyone's ever written, perhaps apart from the Doctor Who theme. But it comes
written by the same person.
Exactly. But I think it's a perfect theme tune, and it has a perfect opening sequence to go with it. I think I've said this before, but if I was able to play a scene of anything, either television series or film, and I could take part in it, I would be the prisoner walking down the dark corridor, opening the doors and banging my fist on the table and this letter of resignation going down on the table and the coffee cup going everywhere. It's just classic.
I have to tell you this story before we move on. My best friend, Andy, huge Prisoner fan, and he told me this. Now, I always like to believe that it's true. He went into his boss's office with a small tape recorder, put it on the desk, pressed play, then left the room. And then as the Prisoner theme music came on, he went back into the room and put his resignation on the table and then left the room with the music still playing. And that is apparently how he resigned from working at the DSS in North Shields.
That is absolutely brilliant.
And
that's
you know
genius.
What? It's what he told me. He said he'd always dreamed of doing it. And I just realized I've never shared that one with anyone.
That's superb.
And that is how you resign. That is just how you do it.
Listeners, do share similar stories if you have ever had the gall. The gall?
Yes, the gall.
Yes, to do that. Okay, so final thoughts, Dad, before we move on to spot the Doctor Who actor.
Well, I'm quite happy to admit that there's so many plot holes in the story. I'm glad to admit that Nigel Stock doesn't look like, or doesn't even remotely behave like Patrick McGoohan. But I still play the episode probably more frequently than most other episodes because it's just, for me, it's one of those things that is very appealing. There's one thing we didn't talk about at the beginning, which I've forgotten. But it'll come back after we've finished. So I've basically finished my.
We can always record an addendum at some point.
Yes, yes.
Any final thoughts, Michael, before we move on?
You know what? I don't know why it's universally disliked. That was one of the things we were discussing while you were away. We were trying to figure out what it was that puts people's backs out. Because apparently, you know, it's well shot. It's very well edited. Apparently, McGoohan went back and did some more edits. And arguably, that's where some of the stuff where Stock was looking a bit more McGoohan-y was removed. But we'll never know. So we just don't know why. Is it because it goes against so many other things that are part of the canon? I just can't work out why it's disliked, because it's a perfectly decent episode with a perfectly good plot. Yes, it's, you know, it's Doctor Light, it's Prisoner Light, but that just brought out some decent writing and some great performances. So I've got no real issues.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy it too. I suspect it's probably because it's not in the village that people don't like it. That it's and obviously the girl who was deaf. Living in harmony to some extent, are not in the village too. But we will talk about those in the coming weeks.
Indeed.
As far as you are concerned, podcast listeners, have we revealed to the listeners that we're doing this immediately after arrival?
No, not at all.
For those who are kind of following along, we recorded Arrival and now we've recorded this, which is very odd to be like not have done any of the intervening episodes. This is going to be all over the shop as far as we're concerned. You listeners will be listening to this in the Blu-ray order. Before we go, we will do Spot the Doctor Who Actor, as we do every week. And we will start with Dad. Who did you spot? There are three to get.
Three, okay.
And I suspect... One of them you won't get it because it's a tiny part and it's a missing story. But the other one you should get.
Are we talking about classic Doctor Who?
We're talking about classic Doctor Who, obviously, because, well, I suppose it's conceivable that somebody could have been in The Prisoner and then be in modern Doctor Who 50 years later. But
Was John Wentworth in Doctor Who?
No.
No, okay. Because he was in lots of things at the time. He was a sort of archetypal, older, upper-class person, except when he played a Native American chief in Last of the Mohicans, which was very strange. Anyway, we're off the point again. Was Nigel Stock himself in Doctor Who?
Yes, Nigel Stock.
What was he?
He was in a Peter Davison story called Time Flight, which is also universally loathed by Doctor Who fandom.
Oh, right.
And generally rightly so. I mean, he's probably the best thing in it. Actually, that's not true. There's lots of good actors in it. Just the plot and the direction are all a bit bobbins.
Oh, I think you'll find it's the design. That's what? My main issue with time.
Oh, the design is a mess. Yes. So, yes. So Nigel Stock, because he died in the 80s, I believe. So it was probably one of his last.
Yes, he wasn't long after he was Mr. Pickwick in Pickwick Papers.
Yeah.
He died of a heart attack, I think, didn't he, poor chap? Yeah.
Nigel Stock is one. The other two are much smaller parts.
Much smaller parts in the episode?
Yes.
Okay, so. Ooh.
They both had much bigger roles in Doctor Who, but you will not have seen you will probably not have seen one of them.
Well, remember that I didn't really watch Doctor Who after John Pertwee because I was.
Yeah, well, they're both Patrick Troughton era.
He had a life. Yeah.
They're both Patrick Troughton. Okay. So contemporary with this Prisoner episode, they were both in Doctor Who.
No, you've got me. I haven't got
it. I'm trying to think of other characters. So. The only other characters I can think of are Janet, was she in it?
No.
Xena, no.
The people talking to his boss in the office.
No. I'm gonna have to reveal it to you now.
Yeah, tell us. Yeah.
We're gonna go with the one that you probably wouldn't have got, Dad, first. Gertan Klauber, who plays the cafe waiter. Who tells him where to find Seltzman in the Austrian village?
I certainly wouldn't have got that. No,
he played Ola in the Macra Terror, which interestingly has some parallels with the Prisoner, because it's about a colony that has been infiltrated and taken over. But the sort of the whole sort of happy, everybody's happy kind of vibe is very much there, and that was the same year as the Prisoner. That was 1967.
I don't remember the Macra Terror. Sorry,
It's missing. It has been reanimated.
There's no such thing as the Macra.
There's no. Yes, it has been reanimated in recent years. But you should have got James Bree, Dad.
Oh, of course. He doesn't always look like James Bree in this episode. Is he one of the people that works for? When he confronts Danvers, is he the one that comes in and takes him off to the boss?
He's the one that takes him up to in the Paternoster lift.
Oh,
yes.
Okay, James Bree, of course. Yes. How could I forget? But he's playing a very different part to.
He's playing a very different part.
The
yes.
War Games.
Yes.
And he's playing with a normal voice rather than
his yes very weird his... performance in the War Games. Yes, and also later Nifred in Full Circle with Tom Baker.
Of the three rule?
He's one of the deciders in Full Circle.
Right.
Yeah. So yes. But I mean I didn't recognise him for years, and then I was looking at the cast list and was like, oh yeah, and then you watch it, you're like, oh yeah, yeah. Very different performance. And obviously without the glasses, and also in colour, so yes. You're not immediately recognisable. Anyway.
Yes.
I think we need to wrap up. So Michael has the traditional sign off. We will say goodbye. I'll say goodbye to you, Dad.
Be seeing you.
Be seeing you.